This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
This weekend, the third and final installment of the latest Star Wars saga hit theaters. The Rise of Skywalker ties together the previous eight films in just under 2.5 hours. And in that time, it also managed to squeeze in something that those other films left out, that there are LGBTQ plus people in a galaxy far, far away.
And in the case of the LGBTQ community, you know, it was important to me that people who go to see this movie feel that they're being represented in the film.
That's director J.J. Abrams during an interview with Variety earlier this month. In the lead up to the film's release, he hinted that there would be real LGBTQ representation in The Rise of Skywalker. But when the film premiered last week, it was finally revealed that two minor female characters kiss during a split-second scene. Many are saying it's yet another example of a major Hollywood franchise teasing LGBTQ representation and then not following through in a meaningful way. Joining me now is Kyle Buchanan, a pop culture reporter at the New York Times. Kyle, hi, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Emily, hi, welcome.
It's so great to be here.
Now, I don't want to spoil too much for our listeners who haven't seen the movie, so let's leave plot aside as much as we can. But both of you have seen the movie. Kyle, maybe you can start by telling us about the same-sex kiss scene in the new Star Wars movie and why it's gotten such a big reaction.
Sure, I'd be happy to tell you because I think people who've actually watched the movie, if they blinked, might have missed it. So let me fill them in as well. There is an extremely brief moment in the third act where a character who has had, at that point, maybe two lines, certainly wasn't named, kisses her female partner in a victory celebration of sorts. Goes by extremely fast. And, you know, if that had been a thing that people had seen in 1977, say, when the first Star Wars film came out, it would have been pretty significant. But I think the irony here is that, especially this last film, The Rise of Skywalker, is doing so much to try to satisfy fan demands, but it's not really doing it in a visionary, bold way that would satisfy anybody's asks and requests. And so even though there have been fans who've asked for the characters played by John Boyega and Oscar Isaac to have some sort of romantic relationship in Star Wars, this is sort of the sop to that, and I don't think it's going to satisfy all that many people.
Now, we just heard the director, J.J. Abrams, a few minutes ago. That was him speaking during the press tour for the film. And he mentioned LGBTQ representation. He went out of his way to say it. In fact, there are some critics who have called what he said now a classic example of queerbaiting. Emily, maybe you can explain what that is.
So queerbaiting is the idea that there is some sort of movie or TV show, especially, but it can also happen with books or other forms of fictional media, where two characters who are presented as platonic friends within the text of the show, then fans often become, you know, interested in the idea of them having a romantic relationship. An example of this from these new Star Wars movies would be Finn and Poe, who are not really presented as romantic partners in that first movie, The Force Awakens, but the internet took that and ran with it. And these future movies have sort of played to that in interesting ways. A far more egregious example was the TV show Sherlock, which recently aired with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. And that show, the fans started sort of shipping, which means hoping to see two people end up together, Sherlock and Watson on that show.
Right.
And it did not transpire, and it turned into like the creators sort of baiting those expectations without actually doing anything about it. It can be really kind of a nasty way to deal with your fandom.
Now, to go back to Star Wars for a second and what Abrams said during the press tour, why the fake out? I guess it's easy to assume that dipping an ambiguous toe into LGBTQ representation is meant to appease certain audience who want to see that representation, without going so far as to anger more conservative audiences. How much is it about that dynamic?
It's definitely about that dynamic. Like, there is sort of this air of they're trying to sort of make the right people mad, by which I mean the really extremist people who don't want to see any LGBTQ representation. And like, you know, if there's a 2-second kiss, most of America is going to be like, okay, whatever. But like, they're also not trying to push the envelope in terms of that representation in ways that might force people to sort of rethink their preconceptions or their prejudices or anything like that. It is just like the least risky way to deal with this material, but also in a way that gets them these headlines and, you know, publications that are like, oh, bold new ground for the Star Wars franchise, when you see the movie and it's literally nothing like that. So it makes them get to seem progressive without actually having to be progressive. And that's kind of the way that they play their publicity game.
I want to ask each of you what meaningful representation would look like. GLAAD, the LGBTQ media advocacy organization, uses this metric that they made up. It's sort of similar to the Bechdel test. They call it the Vito Russo test after GLAAD's co-founder. And to pass the Vito Russo test, a film has to have a character that is identifiably LGBTQ. That character must not be solely defined by their sexual orientation or gender identity. And that character must be tied to the plot in such a way that their removal would have a significant effect. So, Emily, why don't you start? Do those criteria sound right to you when we ask what is meaningful representation? Would you add anything to it?
I certainly don't disagree with any of those criteria. I'm happy to have that sort of as a starting point. But I think that, you know, there's room for stories about LGBTQ plus lives, like that are actually about our lived experiences. And it's not like they don't exist. There's plenty of great queer art made every year. It's just that it's not, you know, happening in major studio franchise films. I think if we're looking for a major studio franchise film to tell stories that, you know, fit that sort of GLAAD description, it's not impossible, but it's also like, you know, it's hard to talk about our identities in a nuanced way when aliens are invading the planet or something like that. So I do think there's room for improvement, but a lot of the stuff that we're looking for is often happening in like indie film and television and, you know, stuff that's supported by Patreon, by independent artists.
I think Emily is right, and I think that queer viewers had just sort of gotten used to expecting and looking for that representation elsewhere, which is why it would be a significant new thing to see it in the forum of the, you know, superhero or science fiction spectacular. And I don't think it has to be, you know, as Emily also said, these films don't often stop for very long to consider the, you know, the minutia of the characters' inner lives, but just the presence, that counts for something. I mean, Avengers Endgame culminates with this finale, this orgiastic finale of dozens upon dozens upon dozens of characters. And you know, it wouldn't be so hard for just one, or maybe a couple of those people to be on the queer spectrum somewhere. That's how life is. And if these movies are drawing from life and then making something superpowered, it just seems like a notable omission for the only times for them to acknowledge that queer people exist is when they shuttle in a character for one scene.
Kyle Buchanan is a pop culture reporter and award season columnist at the New York Times, and Emily Vanderwerf is a critic at large for Vox. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.